As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
I mean, I think what's interesting about these newer generations is how insistent they are on authenticity and integrity when it comes to the product that they're consuming. And it's sort of like mass scale artisanal interest. It's not interesting if it doesn't have an artisanal sense to it. And now that I've appreciated that artisanal quality, I want it everywhere I go.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds from the top people in tech. This week on the program, we have a two for one. I sat down with Danny Reimer and Jan Hammer, who are both partners at Index Ventures, the venture capital firm. They invited me over to their very sleek offices in San Francisco, and we sat down and talked about a whole load of things. I mean, you may know you may not know Index, but you'll definitely know a few of their big hits, including companies like Skype, way back in the day, Sonos, Dropbox, Deliveroo, Etsy, Just Eat, Facebook, Blue Bottle Coffee, etc. You get the idea. Now, Index is also interesting because it's one of the very few companies or very few venture capital firms that's truly transatlantic. So they started out in Switzerland many, many years ago, then went to London, then opened an office in San Francisco about a decade ago. And they have a pretty even split now of companies between Europe and the US. So that gives them a bit of a different perspective on kind of what they look for, the things that are important to them, what makes a good company, etc. So we talk about that. And we talk about what it's like as a venture capitalist where you spend your days just hearing one off-the-wall idea after another and then deciding which one of those crazy ideas might actually work and become the next big thing. So we talk about all kinds of stuff. We talk about flying cars, how they try to get inside the minds of young people to figure out kind of what's coming next. We talk about whether we are seeing the end of cash coming into view and a whole lot of other stuff. But we started on one of my favorite topics, which are scooters, you know, electric scooters. Index, you see, is a very big investor in the biggest startup in that booming, totally ridiculous industry, Bird. So I asked them a simple question, why? And so without further ado, here they are, Danny and Jan, to answer. Enjoy. Speaking of dreaming big, you guys invested in Bird, and I've done some stuff on scooters and spoken to some investors. I spoke to one guy, Sar Gur,
yep,
who was invested in Bird, and he was talking about how this kind of last-mile mobility will yield an Apple-like company, and this is a kind of a generational innovation, which all sounds... I mean, if you look at a scooter, it looks kind of a bit silly, but what do you think?
We're pretty bullish on the space.
Yeah.
I mean, we're pretty bullish on the fact that the last mile, as a result of all of the transformation that's going on in the transportation space, is going to generate some very, very sizable companies. Because of a combination of modality, the way that you're able to be transported, and also because of behavior that is being unleashed for the first time.
What do you
mean? So in other words, before there were no opportunities to get from point A to point B quickly, safely, economically, ecologically, wasn't there. There were bike lanes. You had to cycle. You couldn't really deal with hills. You couldn't really pick it up in one place and drop it off in another. I mean, there's just so many aspects that are happening.
And you arrive sweaty.
You arrive gross. You have to pick up that bike and port it up to your, you know. So those aspects are changing. The way that we think of transportation, the fact that it's immediate gratification, that we can just turn on an app and, you know, for longer distance, we can carpool if we're going to work with Scoop, which we're really excited about, or obviously use blah blah in Europe, you know, from going from...
What is blah blah?
Oh, blah blah car. Blah blah car is a really interesting company. It's a French company that provides...
Is it bleu bleu?
It's blah blah. Exactly. It's actually an interesting name. It was called blah blah because depending on how vocal you wanted the passenger to be, you could say whether it was blah 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 or blah blah blah. And so the concept was for long haul rides, you could pick up some passengers, make a few euros and drive them from Paris to Lyon or Paris to Aix-en-Provence and distances that are quite significant but couldn't be replicated in the U.S. because the U.S. is so massive.
So you're kind of disrupting hitchhiking.
That's right. And now it's integrated into the bus system and into the train system. The point is yes, Uber and Lyft have been transformational, but actually what they've done is they've expanded the scope of all the different ways that you can be transported from point A to B. And there are all these new economically feasible ways of getting there. And we think that, I mean, one of the benefits that we feel we have is by looking at the innovation that's happening in Europe and in the U.S., we can look at scooters and motorcycles and mopeds. And, you know, we looked at pretty much everything and concluded that actually electric scooters was a really viable alternative. And then it was a question of which team that can actually, as you can tell, we're quite passionate about it.
Yeah, well, it makes me think of this quote from Dara Khosrowshahi at Uber, who said, you know, the car is just, that's kind of step one. They want to be a much bigger transport company, and that's just the beginning. I can't imagine what else that would include aside from maybe scooters, which they've invested in Lime, I believe.
Yeah, and they bought Jump, which I think is an electric sort of scooter company.
Yeah.
Electric bike company.
Are there any other kind of forms of transport that people are messing around with?
Hoverboards? No, kidding.
Anything that you guys are getting excited about in terms of just this whole, like, you know, the holistic, no matter where you want to go door to door, there's going to be a way to kind of get there.
Yeah, it's definitely an area that we keep on looking at.
Perhaps worth quickly mentioning a company in our European portfolio called Citymapper, which
came out
of London and is not a transport company in itself, but it's a transport data company that ultimately tries to map everybody's journey and the most effective way of getting from A to B. There's this concept that I guess you have just been discussing, this kind of multimodal, because your journey may include more than one mode of transport.
And are you guys looking at flying cars at all? That seems to be a thing.
Flying cars, no, but actually autonomous vehicles, so actually self-driving cars is a big area for us. So we backed this company called Aurora that is led by Chris Urmson, who worked at Google for 12 years.
At Waymo?
That's right.
Right. Because we had another guy on this podcast, Stefan Krauss, who runs eVelocity. I don't know if you've heard them. They raised $1 billion. He used to be at BMW, and they're creating a car from the ground up. Is that what they're doing, or is they doing software?
Yes, it's the software. It's sort of taking all of the learnings, all of the pattern recognition, everything that's happened in the autonomous vehicle space through a huge amount of work and history, trying to come up with a software layer that will be really helpful to the OEMs, to the car manufacturers.
Right.
So to provide, you know, the internal intelligence for these cars as they are driven around autonomously.
And how come no on the flying car scene at the moment?
I mean, as you know, a big part of what we do is timing. It's timing, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't say no to the concept very often. It's just a question of when.
So you guys are investors in Deliveroo. Is that independent in a year?
Yes.
Because there's lots.
I mean, you know, this is one of the core tenets of Index, which is we invest in companies and in entrepreneurs who want to remain independent and want to see their vision through fruition. And that means being an independent company. And for a company like Deliveroo that's been so innovative and has executed so well on the delivery of, you know, great food. I mean, in contrast to...
It's way better than anything we have here.
It's just night and
day. Because having moved here, whatever it was, a year and a half, almost 2 years now, God, I do miss Deliveroo.
And it's only gotten better. It's incredible, right? Really? Because of the density.
Caviar, DoorDash, all these, they're not good.
You said that.
Yeah, I did.
Note, we didn't say anything.
They nodded.
We didn't even
they
nod.
Nodded it. They nodded
yeah, nor I nodded.
Your job is so fascinating because you guys get to see all the kind of wide-eyed entrepreneurs coming through with like the craziest ideas. What's exciting at the moment? If there's like one or two that you could think of right now that would be kind of out of left field that people wouldn't know about.
Well, we're taking a shot at, you know, industries that touch our daily lives. So mm-hmm. you spoke about transport, you know, one is another one is healthcare. And again, you would say, you know, what has that got to do with venture capital? We begged this company out of France called Alan. That's
Alan, like my name is Alan?
As in Alan Turing.
Oh, okay.
A-L-A-N.
Yeah.
And they started as an insurance company, sort of health insurance carrier, full stack insurance company. Mm-hmm. But that's only the start of a journey. And the journey is a sort of a connected health vision, sort of vertically integrated company, a health platform, all in one, in an app with a range of services, whether that's telemedicine at the back end. Yeah. And, you know, we've invested in a very ambitious company called Cree out of Sweden that actually is now collaborating with Alan on delivering a healthcare service. So you sort of start with, we talk about fintech, we talk about insurance. And again, it's not just insurance in and of itself. The vision is far broader in terms of sort of holistic healthcare.
John Hancock, they would just announced, I think it was last month, that going forward in the US, they are no longer going to write policies that are not quote unquote interactive policies. So there's going to be some kind of health tracking using a Fitbit or whatever, and that you can basically get bonuses, you get free Amazon Prime if you take a certain amount of steps or do whatever. Because my dad used to sell insurance. Actually, I used to sell insurance way back in the day for my sins. But it was, you just take a bit of information, have somebody come to your house, they take your pulse, and then they give you a policy, and then that's it. But it feels like that model isn't going to be around very long.
Yeah, I would say two factors. One, on sort of the input side, you know, in the olden days, you'd go to your physician, you go once a year and get your, you know, measurements, you know, your blood pressure or other sort of vital stats measured, and, you know, that'd be one yearly sort of episode of an observation. You know, wearing an Apple Watch today, you're getting hundreds of observations per day. So there's a vast amount of data that you can work with. On the other side, of course, you've got current healthcare systems, whether they are sort of commercial healthcare system in the United States or the state covered or sort of part state, part employer covered in Europe. And all we know is that the pressure on the payer wallet is enormous. You know,
we're
talking about 20% of GDP being spent on care. But at the same time, we do know that we have all this input data. We know what the right behaviors are. And we know a lot of the chronic condition is manageable, preventable, and so on. So the opportunity is enormous if only the care got connected. And I guess what we've witnessed on both sides of the Atlantic has been, you know, there may have been different approaches, but the one failing has been common between the two of them is that the units in the sort of the value chain of the healthcare system have been disconnected.
Yeah.
And they're not talking to each other. And technology here is an enabler to precisely provide that connection and really deliver better outcomes, you know, better value, and ultimately, you know, healthier lives.
It's going to be quite tricky, though, because it's a bit big brothery, to have, you know, it's kind of like telematics in a car that tracks how fast you drive and all this stuff. And this is obviously much more important. This is your health care data and what you're doing and what you're putting in your body and how it's reacting, etc. I imagine it's going to have to be, there's going to be some tricky ethical questions as that rolls out.
Yeah, no doubt. I agree with you. I would say building a business with trust and integrity and sort of safeguarding private data is vital, but it's not just in healthcare. So, you know, if we zoom out of healthcare, you know, that's ultimately the case in banking and in insurance. It's the case in anything to do with mobility, for that matter, you know, your location data. So ultimately, it's the how to, not the what. It's sort of, you know, Danny mentioned in the context of cities and transportation, you know, concerns like the environment and pollution, which of course, in, you know, it's a big topic in China.
Yeah.
So it really becomes a part of the debate of how to deliver good business, not, you know, it's sort of not optional. And clearly, safeguarding data is a big deal. We made an investment in a data management software company called Colibra that has been growing gangbusters on the back of GDPR,
yeah,
on the back of managing data, yeah, privacy. And it is a big deal.
I'm working on a story for this week, actually, on content moderation. And people like Facebook, who are kind of trying to retroactively figure out how to do this. And I was talking to one of the content moderator companies, and they're saying, you know, the newer companies are trying to bake this in from the beginning. I'd love to get your perspective as whether companies, now that we're 20 years into the internet, and the internet is what it is now with all, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly, if people are more thoughtful when they're setting up companies about, rather than just like, let's just get big fast, as opposed to let's be a bit more thoughtful and careful.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that not only are they being more thoughtful, but they're also sort of being very honest about whether or not they've been thoughtful enough and whether or not they have to reevaluate sort of on an ongoing basis what their policies are. And in certain cases, it's tough because they actually have to take a stance and take a position which might alienate a number of people, but it's a fact. We have a company called Patreon, yeah, which is this platform that connects basically creators to their fans. It's a constant scrutiny that has to happen to make sure that they are protecting not only the fan, but also the type of content that appears on the platform. And it's a huge endeavor that I think a lot of the entrepreneurs take this as their core responsibility.
I'm just thinking of, and I'll use the example of Facebook, but this idea of the kind of the deification of automation and machines can solve all.
Yeah.
Do you think that is, people are thinking about that in particular in terms of like, well, maybe let's not be so hasty and just be like, well, if we're trying to build something at scale, it must be solved by machines, or it must be kind of looked after by automation, machine learning, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think that's probably, talking to our entrepreneurs, they would view that as a naive view, that it has to be a combination,
yeah,
of automation and human intervention, and that actually that human intervention also scales over time. You know, while
people think that now,
yeah,
because it felt like it was like
there was a
humans
moment,
as a last resort.
That's right.
Type of
there
thing.
Was a moment where, yes, automation was going to be able to solve all of these problems, but there's so much nuance that it has to be this combination. It's something that actually, when we are evaluating entrepreneurs, this is a big part of what we are evaluating, is how realistic is this entrepreneur on the types of challenges that they're going to have to face as a result of the success of the platform. You know, whether it's Patreon or Discord, you know, you're talking about, or Roblox, you're talking about tens of millions of people depending on this communication platform. That was not the case when we were backing Skype back in the day.
Right.
You know, that was just sort of the Wild West, where people were just blown away by this Estonian company, you know, that would just provide free communication for the first time.
I remember when I used Skype for the first time. I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it was magical.
you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's the kind of most out there thing that you've been pitched?
Most out there thing? Yeah, I'm trying to think of something that we actually think is truly off the wall. Yeah. Because we suspend disbelief often. So it takes a lot for us to be blown away by sort of how crazy this concept is.
It doesn't have to be something you necessarily disbelieve, but perhaps somebody who doesn't do what you do and sees these people every day.
I mean, I think that a lot of the robotic endeavors related to food production is
the burger,
an interesting.
The burger bot and the cat, the coffee bot,
and the pizza bot, and the quinoa bots, and those are definitely things that.
There's not a quinoa bot, is there?
Well, there's a company called Itza that actually looks really good. It's one of our former entrepreneurs. He was behind Climate Corp. Dave Friedberg. Yeah. Itza is...
What is Itza doing?
Well, Itza is automating all the cooking and serving of its food.
It's a robot kind of restaurant, effectively?
Yeah, that's what it is. So that's really interesting to see. Can you automate the full production line of food and provide something of high quality to the consumer?
The burger restaurant, which was in stealth...
Right.
For years and years. And then they kind of had a soft launch, but then they've gone quiet again.
And then there was the Juicero debacle. The Juicero.
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, I think what's interesting about these newer generations is how insistent they are on authenticity and integrity when it comes to the product that they're consuming. And it's sort of like mass scale artisanal interest that the brand I know it sounds crazy, but it's sort of that. It's this notion that it's not interesting if it doesn't have an artisanal sense to it, and now that I've appreciated that artisanal quality, I want it everywhere I go,
right?
And that is a driver for a lot of these companies. It's interesting to us that folks are just not interesting in fast, convenient product anymore. They're really searching for something that is of the best quality and is worth their time and their money.
And I don't know if that's a generational thing, but everybody seems to throw up their hands, at least from traditional retail, when you talk about Amazon. Amazon is just killing us, and it's just a question of when, not if. But there do seem to be a lot of kind of micro brands that start to become mega, who, as you say, do a blue bottle and just be like, look, this is a special thing. This is really art. This is a mass scale, artisanal, whatever. In the shadow of Amazon, you can still build something, but there's a lot of these little micro brands growing up.
You're right. I mean, what we call them are micro niches. And so we really seek out those niches because while they seem insignificant, when you actually aggregate the demand that's out there, it actually becomes a huge market. So that led us to invest in Etsy. You could say that Patreon's another example of that, except it's on a media standpoint, or Good Eggs. or first dibs for furniture, or Farfetch for high-end luxury goods. You know, those are all areas on the periphery of Amazon.
Yeah.
They're niches, but those niches are massive. I mean, we did one that I think folks think we're crazy, but we met these entrepreneurs who had gone through Y Combinator and had been building a piece of software, and in the last hour, they decided to spend the last million they had, pivot completely and create a marketplace for sneakers. It's called GOAT, and it's an app.
The greatest of all time.
Like, it's after the greatest of all time, exactly. And it's a marketplace app where you can buy the world's greatest sneakers that have been sort of authenticated by their specialists.
There's a whole world of crazy sneakerheads who will pay obscene amounts of money for like old school Jordans and stuff.
Danny, how do you really feel about them? I mean, I will tell you that I don't think they're crazy at all. Fashion.
No, I can see how that would work because there's enough people who really...
Well, it's not, they're not crazy sneakerheads. They're not like, you know, they're not folks who are really that esoteric or that small as a community. It's actually very mainstream. And what's interesting about sneakers, but I would say about street fashion, is that the interest spans from 12-year-olds to 65-year-olds. And what's interesting is that, of course, historically, you know, fashion has been viewed as something that is led by women, but a huge amount of this movement is actually men catching up to women with a sense of style.
Isn't part of your job, though, to kind of get inside the minds of a millennial or a Gen Z or whatever? No disrespect, but you don't look like you guys are millennials. I think you're probably about my age.
No, you're absolutely right.
So how do you do that? Because at a certain point, isn't it increasingly difficult to kind of age out kind of the trends you're supposed to be spotting?
I think that's a really fair point. And it's a combination of the fact that, you know, the folks that you see in this room do not represent the entire investment team at Index. Yeah. And that we spend a lot of time observing and paying attention to what the market is telling us. And, you know, what are the signals that we can observe from the noise out there. Also coming up with theses that probably a lot of our peers think are pretty crazy, but we think are quite insightful. So one of them around fashion has been, you know, that perhaps fashion is the social lubricant that music was in the 20th century.
That's one of your theses.
Yeah.
Okay.
That youth today...
Do tell.
No. Yeah, that youth today basically actually find other folks that they have a connection with through what they're wearing, through the combination of things that they're wearing. Some of them are generic, some of them are really esoteric, and that actually breaks down social barriers. So when I was a kid, if I went to Nairobi and I started singing Billie Jean, you know, some Kenyan would start singing with me. Today, they'll probably look at, you know, the 18-year-old, what he's wearing, and that will be the connection. Oh, I actually recognize that pair of, you know, that Supreme t-shirt or that, you know, that pair of Air Maxes.
Right.
And oftentimes they're not actually bought new. They're bought used.
Just before you guys walked in, I was reading something on my phone because that's what you do when you have nothing to do these days. And I was reading a story about SoftBank. They're about to invest, I don't know, $15 or $20 billion into WeWork, supposedly. How has the arrival of SoftBank changed things, or has it? Because it just feels like, I mean, if they have $100 billion and they're already talking about raising a new fund, and it seems that they are going to a given sector and just anointing a winner and then just giving them more money than God and say, okay, now beat everybody. And it does seem to have changed the dynamics, at least here in Silicon Valley. I don't know if what your perspective would be.
So definitely there is a world before SoftBank and a world after SoftBank. I mean, to your point, it's $100 billion that they are deploying towards private companies in the tech space.
And $100 billion is like, I don't know, that's just orders of magnitude beyond anything
before. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. The reality is that for us, it doesn't change that much. The way that we digest that is that our companies are likely to be private longer, and that we really have to make sure that we continue to invest in phenomenal entrepreneurs and make sure that they're growing the most successful companies, because they're going to have to win. And sometimes, you know, SoftBank will back them, and sometimes SoftBank won't. And oftentimes, yeah. And oftentimes it makes sense for SoftBank to come in, but oftentimes the entrepreneur or the board doesn't want SoftBank to come in. So I think what it does is it just clarifies the fact that companies have a very significant opportunity, that money is not going to be challenging to get if you're doing a phenomenal job in your respective area, and that it's going to be unbelievably competitive. So you better believe that you want to do this and you want to be passionate. You have the right level of passion to suffer through the good and bad times of what you're going after. And that's an interesting aspect that in some ways, and I, you know, we haven't really talked about it that much, but I think it's actually the Sequoias and SoftBanks of the world who have now decided that they're going to, you know, they're in the mega fund land. In some ways, it's attracted more entrepreneurs because they're thinking, my God, this is it. This is El Dorado. on the other hand, it really has made it very clear that for us, we have to find entrepreneurs that are not doing it because they think that business is moving in this direction, but rather that they're super passionate about their segment and the industry that they're trying to disrupt, and the product that, you know, that it, they're going to provide to the consumer.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the, and this isn't necessarily a SoftBank issue, but I've talked to some people who think there is so much money in the system now, whether it's through, if you're at Facebook and you got in there at the right time, you are loaded. A lot of these platforms are minting people in a way that just, it's always happened, but perhaps not to this scale, and that is kind of skewing the dynamic around who's starting businesses, who isn't, who comes in, who kind of goes off and, you know, sails around the world for the rest of their lives. Just in terms of the sheer money, as these companies become, I mean, I think the five biggest companies in the world are all on the West Coast now, and they all give their workers stock. It just feels like there's a kind of a new reality here that is changing the way the whole industry operates.
A lot of interesting observations in there. So I'd say the first one I would like to touch on is what is the sort of the driver of entrepreneurship? And at the end of the day, what we back as the, sort of the leading indicator of success? And I would say in one word, it's ambition. So it's sort of not what you did yesterday because you were an early employee in Facebook, but what hunger you have and what hoops and what sacrifices you'll make in order to make your next venture happen. And we look for that sort of spark in the eye, that hunger, that, you know, I'll go the extra mile. And there are signals we look for. You know, we call it sort of mission-driven as opposed to mercenary. Mission-driven meaning I've experienced a problem that I'm so keen on solving. I'm going to drop what I'm doing and I'm going to go and solve that problem and I'll overcome obstacles. And that's really uncorrelated to whether you have made no money, some money, or a lot of money. Right. And we've backed, with Danny and our partners, we've backed first-time entrepreneurs. We've backed second-time entrepreneurs, in some cases, third-time entrepreneurs. The distribution is actually pretty even. The second thing I would touch on is your observation on sort of where those very large outcomes have come from. And I think you're right, pointing at some of these extremely large platforms that predominantly have come from California. Yeah. I would sort of nuance that is that that's changing. And I would say the world is getting flatter. The access to global markets is now from anywhere. And if you sort of look, you know, if you step back, it, you know, Danny mentioned Skype, and that was an exit from the index stable in mid-2000s, and that was sort of the first more than $1 billion before that U word was invented. Super successful exit. And if you just look at this year alone, I mean, we have had seven IPOs so far. from the index portfolio family. But the origin of those companies is really pretty global. They're not all Californian companies. You know, look at a company like Adyen, came from a very humble, modest sort of background out of Amsterdam. And many people have not heard the name, but everybody's heard of their customer names.
Yeah.
And that's a company that's gone to be sort of more than a $20 billion public company. And not just to talk about our own portfolio. Look, Spotify, you know, to speak of the music industry, came out of Europe, more than a $30 billion company. And again, it's just, it's not to only champion Europe. It's to make the point that, you know, you look at Chinese companies, you know, Meituan just went public, more than a $50 billion company.
I've never even heard of it.
And you've got number of these very, very large outcomes coming out of China. And a lot of these names, as is exactly as you say, they are not household names.
Yeah.
Yet they are addressing massive audiences, massive user bases with huge revenues because, you know, the population is that large.
Yeah. And I imagine just because everybody has the supercomputer in their hand, the opportunities are probably, I don't know, historically greater than at any time in the history of venture capital, I would guess.
And that's why we are so excited about the opportunity we see today. Exactly right. And I would actually go even further, and I would reinforce that rarely we would consider, sort of in our partner meeting when a company presents, rarely would we now see a business that wouldn't, out of the gate, have a plan to be a global business. Perhaps back to where we started this conversation, sort of a decade ago, that might have looked different. You'd be building a company in a particular European market, or maybe for Europe, you're a British company, you'd sort of say, well, the next market is France, as an example.
Yeah.
But really, out of the gate, today we're seeing European companies wanting to go global. You know, US is just one part of that journey, and US companies that are kind of doing the reverse.
Right. I have a question about money. Is cash, like physical money, is it on its way out? You spend a lot of your time investing in fintech.
So I give you two halves of the answer. I would say we believe in electronification trend in general, you know, the sort of the paper to electronic, mm-hmm. the analog to digital.
I've just started using Apple Pay.
And you love it.
It's awesome. It is cool.
Obviously, Apple Pay in itself is just one sort of cog in the wheel, because you need the other side. You need merchant acceptance. You need better terminals. And, you know, if you look at the journey that Adyen has gone through, right? You know, originally started as an online, you know, card not present, you know, you're shopping on the internet.
Yeah.
And of course, because of the vision that was sort of unified single platform for payments, you know, given the fact that 85% of the world payments are actually in store, you know, physical retail, which Danny knows a lot about, you know, that's a massive opportunity, and they sort of backsold for that. But back in the days, the terminal was an analog sort of box on a telephone line, and now it's just an access point to the cloud.
Yeah.
So definitely, if you look at the stats, this trend is only continuing, this what I would call electronification trend. At the same time, cash has not disappeared.
No.
And it's, in a way, a great opportunity to see, you know, startups around sort of the peer-to-peer payments, sort of local. Obviously, contactless has created for the micropayment a wonderful solution. And as Danny talks about sort of these very large niches, whether that's ticketing, parking, coffee, peer-to-peer, there are, you know, payments is probably one of the largest segments we look at, because ultimately every transacted dollar of GDP is ultimately subject to some form of money movement, just by definition. So I guess to conclude this, I mean, it's a sector we just spend a lot of time on, because opportunities keep coming.
You mentioned ticketing. Are you guys doing anything in ticketing? Because we just purchased tickets for Jay-Z and Beyonce, and I know how much I spent on quote unquote processing fees and handling fees and all of this stuff. And I feel like ticketing is ripe for just somebody to come in and just not completely gouge people.
It's a really interesting, I mean,
that
it's a really
it feels
interesting
like an
sector.
Antediluvian industry. people are getting screwed every time they buy any ticket.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think folks, it's sort of like airlines and it's sort of like hotel rooms and it's sort of like all of these areas where, you know, there's scarcity. I mean, we were talking about sneakers, you know, you were talking about folks who, these sneakerheads who are willing to spend $10,000 for a pair of Nikes. It's sort of the same mentality, right? When people want it, they want it.
Yeah.
So I think ripe. The problem therein lies in...
Please spend some time on that, please. Okay. For all of our sakes.
I mean, look, there's so much to talk about. There's so many areas that we could mention. You know, one of the areas that definitely we're super excited about is how companies... We haven't talked about companies, but we should talk about that one day. Like how important company cultures are and how do you really provide a service to help companies retain employees when they've been super successful or when they're unsuccessful, how to make better managers of everyone, how to actually codify best behavior. You know, it's an area for us that historically has been seen as something that is touchy-feely.
I was going to say, it's a bit European. Isn't it?
It's actually, I would say that the Europeans, you know, you look at The Office, right? You remember Ricky Gervais in The Office. Yeah. I would say that the touchy-feely nature in Europe is less prepared for
really
what has to happen from a cultural standpoint inside a company.
Well, because, so here we are, we're sitting, four standard issue white guys.
Yeah.
Including BRs. But I mean, aren't we kind of part of the problem here? In terms of the tech industry and, you know, you get the diversity and the kind of who's making the products, who are they making the products for, how are the people who are not in this club treated, both in terms of products and also within these companies?
Yeah, I mean, I would say what I was pointing at is actually, you know, it's interesting. Are we part of the problem or part of the solution? I think what we're trying to notice is that there is a problem, that culture in companies is something vibrant and something that has to be invested upon and might be the biggest differentiator for that company. Jan was talking about product. You need product, and product is created by people. And so there's a lot of work that has to happen in making sure that those people are happy and are thriving so that they can really sort of blossom. And so that's an area that we are really excited about. One of our companies just announced earlier this week called Humu, that was created
by... companies have great names.
Yeah, exactly. It's the national fish of, or the state fish of Hawaii. It was started by this guy, Laszlo Bock, who wrote that book, Work Rules, because he was the chief people officer at Google for over a decade. And that's really what he's trying to do, is to take those lessons that made the Google culture so successful, not only developing people, but retaining them and providing that capability to all companies out there.
This isn't a gotcha question, but do you guys have any female partners or people of color?
Yes. Okay. Yes, on both.
Oh, okay. Because often it's, I'll have these conversations with a venture capital firm, which I mean is most of them, which don't. Just because it's whatever. I mean, you guys all know the stats. I mean, they're pretty
horrific. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a very important topic on all aspects in terms of, you know, equality and equal access and opportunity, whether it's by race, religion, background, nationality, ethnicity, color, gender, and so forth. And I would just sort of extend that it's not, we believe that's a very important notion, but also that we sort of share that with our portfolio companies, because it's sort of the extended step. Because, of course, our portfolio companies, you know, we are a firm of sort of 50-ish partners and employees, but sort of our companies employ thousands of people.
Yeah, yeah.
So that notion is important, not just for us, but for the companies we invest in.
Yeah. And that is it. I want to thank Danny and Jan, who were very generous with their time, especially as immediately after our chat, they had a party to get to. So Index had a reception that same evening at a very shishi Mexican restaurant that is apparently Reimer's favorite spot to eat in San Francisco. So rather than the typical audio that we usually use on the intro and outro, I thought I'd let Trio Paz play us out, who were there playing that night. I hope you dig that, and I'll talk to you next week. Oh, before I go, one other thing. Give us a rating and review. It really helps other people find the show. Do it now. Anyhow, bye-bye. See you next week.
Helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.